Hi, I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is Episode 81, continuing our coverage of Lightbringer, the sixth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga. This episode is titled Love as Armor, and we'll be discussing Lyria and Virginia's POVs through Chapter 19 in Rampart, Part 2 of Lightbringer.
And I'm regular guest host Seth, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode. That said, don't forget that the opinions are those of us as individuals and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole. Though, let's be real, usually we're all on the same page or very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon. With 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month, it offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. And now we get to rejoin Lyria and Virginia in Love as Armor.
At the end of Dark Age, Lyria was sent off by Pax to find Oculus and have her parasite repaired, but apparently Pax didn't know enough about the city's location because Lyria has been searching for some time to no avail, and this is despite having a crack team with her too, who she's mostly fond of, even if she doesn't love the nickname they've given her. Really, who would want to be called Truffle Pig? They've landed on yet another asteroid that they need to explore, but all they find are the skeletons of some pirates who were killed by an antique bioweapon called the Green Death. Lyria and the half-bionic heavy metal red team leader Fel make their way back to their ship, only to be interrupted by Dustwalkers. The entire crew is killed right before Lyria's eyes, and she even loses a hand, but before the enemy can finish her off, they are taken out by obelisks that rise from the asteroid. As Lyria floats spinning over the asteroid, an orb approaches, asking, "Sister, why do you hide in the warm blood?" And as Lyria passes out, she realizes it isn't talking to her. She wakes naked and patched up, her hand even having been reattached, in a grand room that looks out into an aquarium, of all things. She dresses and dons some shoes, and a door opens, leading her down a path lined with trees to a grove surrounded by rose bushes. A man waits for her there, but not just any man, y'all! It's Mateo, Quicksilver's husband! He is, of course, very kind to Lyria, but she immediately assumes that because she's seeing his face, she's already, well, dead. Yet, as wary as she is, it doesn't take long for Mateo to begin chipping away at her barriers. Lyria eventually admits that she came to the asteroid because the parasite was telling her it needed repairs, but also that she's sick of being small and knows that the parasite is a weapon that makes her stronger. We learn that the parasite is called a psyche and was developed to be an AI partner for the brain that would make the user a god among machines. Only its maker, a woman named Agala, realized a moment too late how dangerous it was. She tried to take it all back. Quicksilver, in turn, tried to force her to continue her work, but Agala simply released six of the early prototypes into the worlds and then took her own life. The TLDR is that whoever wields the psyche could be incredibly powerful, but when Mateo asks Lyria what she would do if they repaired her prototype, she apparently gives him the type of answer he's looking for, because he then explains the cost of its repair. And that cost? Well, turns out to be far more than Lyria is willing to pay, because Mateo says repairing the degraded prototype will cause Lyria to lose some of herself. He isn't sure exactly what or how much, but she could forget who she is, and there will definitely be gaps, holes punched through the story of her life. So while Lyria could have it repaired and become a very dangerous person, the idea that she might not be herself stops her. At first, Mateo is surprised, even confused, but he agrees to remove it and give her everything she needs to return to her nephew, Liam. Oh, and before she goes under, he gives Lyria hope as well by hinting that Darrow maybe didn't die on Mercury. That's where we leave Lyria for now, but at least we're off to Mars to check in on our fave sovereign, Mustang! Virginia. After all, Mateo did in fact inform Lyria that he let one of her messages sneak through, and now Virginia is sending five of the fastest Republic vessels out to find this supposed armory of unknown size. Not that she can tell the people she's sending anything like that, but they understand they're off to do something very important at her behest. And hey, everyone trusts Virginia, or at least everyone who matters does.
Immediately after seeing them off on this mission, Virginia is on her way to the conservatory, a pilot school, with Kavix, because that's where Pax has been for some months. Granted, Virginia was none too happy when he announced his decision to attend, and it led to a good old mother-son fight. But now Virginia has news for her son, news that she has insisted on giving to him in person. While they wait for Pax to arrive, Kavix tries to get Virginia to cough up the name of her source who's been helping her find traitors in their midst. She doesn't, but it seems he already knows who it is anyway. And of course, we don't get that reveal just yet, because just then they're interrupted by Pax finally emerging from the school. He's taller, his eyes harder, his skin pale, and he already has digital tattoos staining his shaved head. Earlier than Virginia expected, though the blues with him inform her that he was chosen for an accelerated track. As a hunter, nonetheless, with the constellation Orion written on his forehead. Pax assumed her visit was due to news of Darrow, but Virginia admits that there are only rumors that he lives. So he wonders if she is there to tell him she's pardoning Valdir, reminding her that the Obsidians only wanted a little of the freedom they died for. But in the end, Virginia is really there to tell him about Lyria and how she is sent a force to find Quicksilver. Unfortunately, Pax doesn't believe that her people have any chance of dragging Quick back into the fight. Not without Darrow, or at least Pax himself, because Quicksilver didn't build statues for Virginia, or Fichtner, or Io, only for Darrow. Obviously, no part of this meeting goes the way Virginia wanted or hoped it would. But in the end, they part with a hug, Kavix shares a few jokes with Pax on the way back to the door, and Virginia realizes that despite it all, she's ready for the enemy. She has more reasons to fight, and her armor is her love. Why, yes, we had to work the episode title into this summary, sorry, not sorry. And speaking of love, Virginia soon has good reason to show it again, as she arrives at the Citadel of Igia, where a Votum torch ship has just landed. She races to the executive lounge, where she finds four dear friends and colleagues, more Darrow's friends than hers, perhaps, but Virginia knows that few people are more worthy of her trust and respect. Harnassus, Screwface, Thraxa, and Calloway have returned to Mars, y'all! Virginia welcomes them back with open arms, and it's soon revealed that it was Darrow and Severo on Venus. So Victra and Virginia now finally know that their husbands are alive. Woot woot. On the other hand, though, they bring news that Lysander appears to be on his way to Mars. So they might not know where Darrow and Severo are exactly, but they do know that they have the Archie and they're resourceful. And right now, what's important is who's fit to fight. A question to which all of the returned friends raise their hands, because of course they do. I mean, what else would they do, really? As the core ships come ever closer, Virginia gathers in Lycos with Deanna, Kavix, Holiday, Victra, and thousands of others to remind the people of Mars what they are all fighting for and against. The crowd begins the fading dirge as Deanna covers Virginia and Victra's gold sigils with mud, and they head back to the surface where Pegasus Legion awaits and will continue to wait until Victra looses them. So Victra and Virginia part ways, with Victra remaining behind to guard Mars from her flagship, while Virginia has to go to Phobos to keep the moon from falling into enemy hands. Hopefully, anyway. Ah, man. Lyria's crew seems so cool.
Yeah.
There's Fel, the red, and she didn't say much about the green or the blue. Like, she described them briefly, but she sounded fond of them, even despite the fact that they've nicknamed her Truffle Pig. Also, how have we never heard of heavy metal reds before?
I mean, I think he's still having ideas. He's not having as many ideas as, say, some other authors we know who are writing extended series. But, you know, he thought of something cool that he wanted to put in there. I will say that, all right, I need to preface this by saying that the author was relatively recently, to my knowledge, outed by a former girlfriend as being a real shitheel. But what Pierce did with them kind of reminds me of what China Myville did with a few characters I can't remember in Perdido Street Station, where essentially, like, about two-thirds of the way through the book, what amounts to a D&D adventuring party shows up and promptly gets slaughtered. And it's like, oh, but those people seem kind of cool. I wanted to know more about those people.
I feel like I need to go back and, like, before you said that, like, preface this with the author's a real shithead. We're not talking about Pierce here.
Yeah, no. I'm definitely talking about China Myville, so I cannot recommend his books in good conscience, but I do remember that bit from Prudido Street Station.
Yeah, because they really do just get...
Yep.
Slaughtered.
They're like, oh, they're going to take care of this nasty dream moth thing. Oh, no, they're not. And then these people, dust walkers. Everybody's just like that.
Yep.
Also, it seems like there probably aren't very heavy metal reds around, one would think.
Yeah, and it also might be a newer thing too, post-Rising during the Republic, because the bionic limbs and stuff doesn't seem like something they would have wasted money on for a red prior.
Well, it seems like they wouldn't have wanted the Reds to have those
That
because,
too.
you know, it's like, yeah. So I'd buy that they're a republic thing and not a society thing. So now Lyria might be super wary of Mateo, but honestly, he's kind of the best from the first moment. He already knows that she didn't sleep well and commiserates with her about how nightmares can be beastly refrains. He had them as a child and then woke into one every single day as a pink. He tells Lyria, "I can never tell which I dreaded more, the nightmares or the reality. I suppose it was the waking hours. In the dreams, there was always the hope it'd be a pleasant one. That's why I admire Red so much. They dread dreams more. At least in the waking hours, they can struggle instead of merely suffer."
When Mateo offers her a seat, Lyria feels like a long-lost relative come to visit, one whose long, bitter road Mateo knows all too well, and she thinks, "The urge to fall into him is nearly overwhelming. I feel seen, but not enough to drop my wits. I don't sit." And in fact, she kind of thinks that because she's seeing his face, she's already dead, which, ooh. And he's like, "How do you know who I am?" And she's like, "Duh."
Yeah.
"How do you think I know? You're literally Quicksilver's husband. Everybody knows who you are, these days anyway."
The more I read about Mateo, the more I'm like, and why are you with Quicksilver again?
Yeah, same hat.
Yeah.
Same hat.
I'm like, because he does a lot of things that are asshole-ish, if not outright evil, and you don't seem to be about that. So what's the deal?
Nah, Mateo's, it becomes very clear. Obviously, we know that he must have gone through a lot as a pink, period.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, the way he talks and some of the things that he says in this chapter are revealing that there's even more to it than that, I think, for him. I want to say this, though, real quick before I dive too much into his character, because I maintain that Lyria and Mateo's conversation in this chapter about Quicksilver cheating the Reds out of the mines is either a retcon or a mistake. I can't remember if it was Iron Gold or Dark Age, and I haven't had the time to look, but I swear the original story that I read in one of them was that the Reds took shares in future profits for the mines, but Quicksilver's books were kept showing the mines not profiting, so the Reds weren't getting any money. And this is like such a specific thing that like, that's yeah. How I know I can't be wrong here, right?
Oh, I remember the same thing.
Okay, but in this conversation, Lyria says they took the immediate payout, unless this is supposed to be payout in shares, like they took an immediate payout, but took it in shares?
It occurred to me while I was reading the recap that you wrote that it's possible, just possible, that this is something that somebody on the society side did somehow. I don't know how they would exactly do that, because it would be a case of showing two different seemingly valid contracts to two different people, where the Reds have this contract that they've signed that says that they are going to get money, and Quicksilver has a contract that he's signed that says that he's going to get the mines. I don't know. I'm going to be insanely peeved if it's Lilith. I'd rather it was a retcon than it be, yes, it's yet another part of this plan so she could set up the disaffection among the, you know, like, yeah, okay, right, okay.
Yeah, I would rather it be a retcon or just an outright mistake than something like that. And again, I will say that there's the chance that when she says they took the immediate payout, she means they took it in shares. But I mean, that doesn't really make sense because shares isn't an immediate payout monetarily. And either way, I'm side-eyeing this until someone can convince me that we both have totally remembered this wrong.
I will go back to it, because Virginia, I remember her specifically thinking, I told the Reds to take the payout, not to take the payment over time.
Okay, so if you remember it being Virginia, that means it had to have been in Dark Age.
Yeah, and I also remember, because we talked about it, at some point on one of these episodes, I said, man, I'm really pissed at Quicksilver for fucking over the Reds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he kept saying that the mines weren't making any money yet, and that's why they hadn't gotten paid in actual cash or credit, whatever. Anyway, maybe I just need to like message Pierce and be like, can you please explain this to me? I don't know if he'd actually answer, but it's bothering me. Please,
all right,
sir.
I will take a bet. I will place $5 down that if you do and he comes back, it's going to be something along the lines of, because that means that he's planned it this whole time, which again, I still think would be bad.
I don't think we need any more twists at this point. Like, this book is supposed to be, as far as I can tell, about closing plot lines, not opening more up.
Consolidating stuff so that when we get into book 4, it's Darrow fighting everybody. I actually kind of hope, really, really kind of hope, because we all know how much of a Virginia stan I am, mm-hmm. that she's the one who ends up taking care of Lilith and the clone.
Well, anyway, speaking of Quicksilver,
Yes, Quicksilver trying to force the creator of the Psyche to continue her work even after she wanted to stop, because as Mateo explains, in its final form, the Psyche would allow a person to wield legions of metal slave soldiers, each one a node within the hive mind. He admits, "I love my husband, but even I fear a world where we rely on the benevolence of a man or woman with so much individual power. If I had that power, even I would become a tyrant. How could I not? There is so much evil to make right."
Which is very Galadriel. Galadriel circa Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah. I would become a dark queen. Great. Yeah, I know. But also, that was the instrument of evil. Maybe if you're not using the thing that Sauron poured all of his soul into. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I still feel like, again, we go back to Mateo. Why are you with Quicksilver again?
Yeah.
I get what he's saying here. I would even become a tyrant because I would have all that power. And there's so many things I would like to do with it against the really bad people. But also,
yeah, I get it. But it's also like Quicksilver has all that power and used it to become the solar system's first quadrillionaire. And for that, I'm like, my dude, that's not why anybody fought this. Nobody fought this battle. Nobody laid their life on the line. Nobody was tortured a lot and kept in a dark room for a year inside a table so you could become a quadrillionaire.
To be fair, in the Sons of Ares graphic novels, Quicksilver does say revolution is a business. So I think he meant for this to happen all along if it succeeded, but
I mean, maybe, but it also, honestly, revolution is a business sounds like the title of a song from the Red Rising musical, where Quicksilver just basically dances around stage talking about how it's easier for him to make money and that chaos is a ladder or something. I don't know. Anyway, look. No, he's not that bad. It's just that he's really, and part of this is how they created the Silvers, although as a person of Jewish extraction myself, I am a little leery of the, yes, we created an entire group of people and all they do is manage the money. I'm like,
I think it would be more questionable if it wasn't for the fact that every other group is, some other type of...
Let me be clear. I'm not saying that Pierce meant it in any kind of anti-Semitic way. I'm just saying that it landed a little close is all I'm saying to that. Now, let's see. Mateo seems surprised when he asks what Leary would do if he repaired her prototype Psyche, and she says she would help the Republic, even bringing up what happened at her camp.
And Lyria explains that, sure, the camps are horrific, but a Talamana saved her, a gold saved her from Reds. And she also mentions that she looked in Virginia's eyes and knows the Sovereign cares. So while they might not all be good through and through, neither is Lyria herself. And at least they're trying to stop the boot from coming down.
Yeah, it's tempting at this point to just throw all of the problems with Republic conspiracy planning, but the business with the camps just sounds like too much bureaucracy getting in the way of stuff. And in this case, too many people in the Republic not really realizing what was going on and sort of voting their own interests to the point of screwing a class of people over.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the Silvers, Quicksilver specifically, were all voting very much in their own interests. And the Golds were voting in the, we want to keep things as close to the way they were before as possible. So,
yeah, that's one of the things that strikes me is that it's really, really hard to have a solid Republic when everybody is sort of genetically programmed to care about a thing. I somewhat wonder if there isn't going to be some sort of, oh yeah, maybe what we should do is either take all this genetic stuff out so we just go back to baseline human, or honestly, my preferred solution, which is just make everybody gold. Just make everybody gold.
Or, well, I mean, or, in the future, or
just give everybody the best possible whatever. Who's got the best stats? Great, good. Everybody's that then. Everybody's as big as an obsidian and as technologically smart as an orange.
I think mechanically smart, would be oranges. Technologically would be greens and or blues, depending on what kind of technology you're looking at. But
yeah, you know, I'm just saying, why not? Why not? It's like, if you have the ability to give humans the best possible everything, why did you separate everybody out in the first place? And I know the answer. and it's terrible.
The psyche, the thing that Lyria has in her head, just going back to the reason why it was destroyed was because the Maker realized how dangerous it was, aka Mateo's, you know, what would anybody with that sort of power do? Probably become a tyrant, even if they meant it in the best way possible. But the one that is in Lyria's head, the only reason it would harm her in any way to have it repaired is because it was already damaged.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess that is kind of what that psyche would do, is make any member of any color, not immortal, not a god really, but make them into a very strong, hyper intelligent, powerful person. That the, I guess, quote unquote, unfortunate thing about this particular case is that Lyria's is damaged, and it's either fix it and keep it and become that, but also lose some or a lot of herself, or remove it.
I don't know. I also question the, I don't want to work on this anymore. This is too dangerous, but go, my six prototypes, go, my pretties, flee out into the universe and certainly don't cause trouble.
It does seem a little bit odd. I mean, they were prototypes, so I guess they weren't going to give the full power of the finished product, because she did destroy the actual finished product.
Yeah.
And part of that might be that she knew that the prototypes would degrade over time, and that's why she was kind of like, ha-ha, chaos.
I honestly hope we don't find out. That's the last thing we need, is that somebody goes, ha-ha-ha, but I have a... Then a bunch of robots show up. I'm just going to be like, come on, man, come on. Talking about psyches and such, Mateo is more surprised when Lyria says she wants a psyche removed rather than repaired at the risk of losing the very essence of herself.
Even after she insists that this is what she wants, though, she, of course, wonders if she's made the right decision, the brave decision, even if she meant what she said. She muses, as a girl, I dreamed of being big and strong, of being carved like Darrow. But I feel I've only just started becoming me. I'm gaining strength from all the bad that's happened to me. To lose that now seems like a betrayal of what I've gone through so far. Worse, it's a betrayal of everyone who's gone out of their way to help me. Oh, Lyria. Do you think she made the right decision? Because I know where I sit on this.
If you gave me that decision in this universe, knowing what I know, I'd be like, nah, screw it. Maybe I'm going to lose some parts of myself, but we're going to need this. We're going to need this in a big way. There's too many of them out there.
Me personally, I would be like, yeah, get rid of some of those memories. Honestly, like, I don't need them. I could do without the PTSD trauma responses to conflict and things that trigger me, et cetera, et cetera. But
well, you hope that they'd take that, not the good stuff. I'd be like, hey, can you get rid of all the embarrassing stuff that just keeps running through my head on a loop?
Yeah, I mean, it's a toss-up what would actually go. And I guess losing some of the good stuff would suck too. But
yeah.
I don't know. There's a part of me that's kind of like, you'd probably still do it, Tara, if you knew that like what you had in you could help you right a lot of wrongs. But the other thing is, depending on what parts of you lose, you might not understand what's right and wrong anymore. You might not be the same person who would go out and try to right the actual wrongs that you've experienced, seen, etc., because you wouldn't have the same connection to them.
Yeah, I mean, you could always ask to put in a safeguard, to be like, what I'm going to need you to do is I'm going to need you to put in something that's going to ideally not kill me, but shut this thing off if I start getting a little too with it.
Yeah. That said, in terms of Lyria, I am solidly on the side of, I am glad she got rid of it.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, why did she get rid of it? She could have been so much cooler. She could have continued to like benefit from the powers it gave her. And I'm over here just like, nah, I prefer it this way. I'm glad she made the decision and is still the same Lyria.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that strikes me that Pierce might have realized how good it was after he started writing with it a little bit and then gone, okay, I need a way to take this out. Like, hey, this thing is too good. We need to get rid of it. Otherwise, it's going to be a walk for the good guys. And if there's one thing I don't like, it's the good guys getting out of this without severe emotional trauma.
Well, I mean, one person having it, I don't think would make that huge of a difference, but it would certainly be a deus ex machina for Lyria's storyline. I don't know. The things I've seen people saying about Lyria getting rid of it and how they don't like that she got rid of it are focused on like she could have been so badass. And I mean, I've already thought she was badass.
She's coming to badassness in her own way, I feel.
And when I say like she's already badass, like I'm not saying she's a badass fighter or anything, but she's been pretty fucking hardcore for a while now. And even before she was hardcore. The first time I read Iron Gold, you know, I kind of was in the same mindset as most of the fandom is like, she's kind of whiny. But then like you go back and you read it again and you realize she's not whiny. She's been through a shit ton of stuff and she has every right to feel negative about the people and things she feels negative about.
Yeah, quite honestly, one of the first things Virginia should have pushed for was, okay, we need to do witness relocation on all of the Gammas. We need to, if possible, get them off of Mars and put them someplace else. But hindsight's 20/20.
Mateo likes Lyria's decisions. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He thanks her, and when she asks what for, he tells her, in life, it is very tempting to forget the past to try and make a perfect future. But the past and the pain we have endured, they make us who we are. Without my past, my pain, I would not be what I am. I forgot that. I remember it now very clearly, thanks to you.
Heart eyes. I love Mateo so much in this chapter. I mean, we've seen very little of him before this, honestly. A little bit with Darrow here and there, basically. And this is just fleshing out a character just a little bit, really, because it's only this one chapter so far. But he's just great. And again, I posit, why are you with Quicksilver, Mateo? I do not understand.
I have now a corollary question, sort of, which is, where's your wise mentoring ass been this whole time?
He did help Darrow. I mean, he was definitely a part of teaching Darrow, but during the Rising, he had to kind of stay quiet because it couldn't be known that him and Quicksilver were actually married and stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah, because otherwise he would have been a great lever, so.
For all we know, after that, he was kind of at least slightly holding Quicksilver back here and there post-Rising during the early years of the Republic. We don't know for sure, but I can hope.
Maybe don't screw the peasants over so much today.
Yeah.
My mental image of Quicksilver keeps defaulting to Albert Finney as Daddy Warbucks. That's what I keep doing with him. And I'm not sure that's right, but that's my head.
So Lyria is having the parasite taken out. We leave her. She goes under to have the surgery. Well, first she bitches out the bot that shaves her head.
Yeah.
And then she actually asks Mateo, like, have you ever had your head drilled into? And he's like, yeah, actually I have. And that was kind of an interesting, like, oh God, do I want to know? Probably not. But also curious still. And we leave her there, hopefully having the parasite taken out, and she'll come out of that okay. Moving on to Virginia back on Mars. I just have to kick our discussion of Virginia's chapters off with, we have to talk about who Virginia's inside source might be. As Kavik says, the reputation of her omniscience grows. Four traitors in a week, you know. But if the gods have taught us anything, it is that prescience always comes with a price.
Virginia knows he wants to know what price she's paying, and Kavix insists that whoever her source is, she could tell him, but she can't bring herself to say the name, merely telling him, imagine the worst and it is true. Only when he holds her tighter and kisses her head, she realizes he already knows. However, still sad when Virginia admits, I didn't want to break your heart by telling you the truth.
And Kavix merely replies, daughter, you are my heart. I trust you like I trust the vaulting sky. I look up and there it is. Different shades, perhaps, but always there. Always true. Which is, of course, very sweet. But really, all that sweetness aside, who is the source? My two thoughts are, could Abominadrius have turned sides? But then also, I think it's more likely to be Publius, especially as Virginia immediately thinks of Daxo during this conversation. And Publius was more directly connected to his death, to Daxo's death, let's be real. But I don't know. Do you have any thoughts? I feel like the fandom is leaning toward it being Abominadrius, but I'm still stuck on it's probably Publius.
Yeah. All right. So here's the deal. I don't think Abominadrius is... We already talked about he's got this really complex need to prove himself to his sister thing that she took advantage of. But after she threw the freaking flower at him and he almost died, I don't think he's going to be too quick to be like, that's right, dear sister. I will tell you the names of some traitors. Yeah, I don't think that's what he's doing. It's not Lilith, because why? Publius seems most likely, but also, I guess my question about Publius is, if it's Publius, then he would be suspect number one on my list if all of a sudden my informants or moles started dying, you know?
Yeah, and there's also the question I understand of how he would have gotten to the point where he could know the things that are being passed on to Virginia and also be able to pass them on to her, because last we knew, he was being treated as like a literal dog. The other thing about both of those is that last we knew, they were on Luna, Now, granted, they could have gotten away from Luna, but Luna is shut down under siege. There's like cannibalism and shit going on there because they're running or have run out of food, et cetera, et cetera. So like if they didn't get off Luna, how do they have this information of core traders?
Yeah.
In, you know, Virginia's midst, and how are they passing it to her? I mean, being able to pass it to her seems a little bit easier to explain, but how would they know in the first place, I guess? So there's always a chance that it's someone completely unexpected within Lysander's inner circle, or at least maybe not inner circle, but the outer rim of the inner circle, something like that. But then again, we go back to, but then again, we go back to how would that person be, think of the worst person, and it's that person.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, I can see Atalantia dropping the dime if it's going to screw Lilith, because she really dislikes Lilith, as, by the way, should everyone. The minute somebody's like, yes, Bone Riders are cool, you should just punch him in the face and walk away. But the only other worst I could think of is maybe Apple, and he's too far out. He's not in anybody's inner councils enough to know.
Yeah, he was kind of one of those that was on my original list, but then I was like, nah, I don't think it would be Atalantia, because it seems to be Atalantia and or like Lysander's people that Virginia is finding out about and removing summarily.
Yeah.
So I don't think it would be Atalantia. Apple goes again into that pot of like, how would he be think of the worst person? And it's that person, you know, like, yes, Apple's bad, but
other people are worse.
Way, 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 way worse.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a lot of speculation, I know, but there's this part of me that's like, I just don't want it to be some random new person or some person that makes no sense to have been the worst for Virginia and Kavix, you know?
Yeah, it's just rough. Although I would at this point like to remind Pierce that if Virginia dies, she'd better not. Darrow can die. You can kill him off. That's fine. That's what he's been looking for this whole time. If you put a sign saying a martyr's death up in front of Darrow, he'd be like, oh, he wouldn't even think twice. Don't kill off Virginia. I will be so pissed.
Just label the road martyr's death way. And he's like, yes, that is the road I shall take.
I want to be clear, before he goes on that road, he's like, all right, army, you can't follow me down this road. I gotta do this alone. And everybody's like, oh, I guess Darrow gonna Darrow. All right.
Anyway, so when Virginia goes to visit Pax, she admits to him, to her son, that it wasn't fair for her to bring a child into this world and that she should have waited. And when Pax asks if she wishes she had waited, she's like, no, because then you wouldn't be you and I think you're perfect, but still, Virginia, maybe you should have thought that through before saying that to your child, your only child.
Well, to be fair, I read that more as being like, honey, we really fucked up here. We gave you a situation that is entirely out of control and terrible, and that was not maybe a great thing to do.
For sure. But I also just am on the, especially since when they went their separate ways, when he went to the conservatory, they did so having just had a fight because she didn't want him to go. And now she's seeing him only very briefly. And he already has an attitude with her. And she says that. Yeah. And it's like, sovereign, my sovereign.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we all have weaknesses, and hers are her family. But we knew that. Pax, by the way, then tells her, oh, gosh, do I have a voice for Pax? I don't. I'm not going to do a joke voice for Pax. Let's see. I'm like, I'm not going to do a joke voice for Pax. He's a teenager, right? Mother, your inheritance was... No, I'm not. We're not doing that.
Nah, Pax is a pretty serious kid.
Yeah. All right. Mother, your inheritance was guilt. Father's was surrender. Because of you, because of father, mine is struggle. That is better than guilt. It is better than surrender. I do not blame you. I thank you. You never pretended the world wasn't broken, even when a broken world favored you. I think if love is anything, it is truth. If life is anything, it is struggle. You taught me that. Father taught me my life is not my own, not unless we win. So do not come back here. Do not think of me. Fix your gaze on our enemies. Fix your heart on the struggle and win. That's honestly a very, very flowery, and I will say somewhat updated, comeback with your shielder on it. It's sweet, but the underlying sentiment is go focus on beating them. Go out there. Go out and get them.
Yeah, the end of it is pretty harsh. But again, Pax, he does kind of have it right here. It's not going to help either one of them if she's distracted by thoughts of him and their relationship while she has to fight kind of like the battle for not just her life, but tens of thousands, maybe millions of lives between Phobos, actually really millions of lives between Phobos and Mars. She's got a job to do and she's got to do it. And she's thinking about him and worried about him all the time when he's holed up and hopefully safe in the conservatory. I feel like that's not going to last very long, but he's got it right.
Yeah, no, he's right. He's grown a lot over the past 6 months, having been kidnapped and then re-kidnapped and then unkidnapped.
Having, you know, killed a torch ship and
he's been through a lot.
Thankfully, the other reunions Virginia has in these chapters are a little bit more positive. I've loved all of the Screwface action we've gotten in Dark Age and so far in this book. Shit, even when he was being all pessimistic, to be honest, I was loving it. But then seeing him through Virginia's eyes is just, it's so good. It's just something else.
Yeah. When she goes to him after embracing the others, she notes, "I softened the most for Screwface. I saved him for last so I could spend the most time on him. He was my school friend, but I know he always worried that he was a hanger-on. His face is not the same as it was at the Institute, but his eyes have never changed. They've always been insecure, I think. While Severo learned to put knives into the soft places of those who told him he was worthless, Screwface believed his tormentor's words a little too much and grew to think if only he was a little taller, a little more handsome, a little more sophisticated, then maybe he would be worthy of love and respect. That is why he agreed to infiltrate the Ash Legions. 3 years with the Devils has taken his toll on him. I embrace him and hold him because he seems to need it. He melts into me and begins to sob like a child. The others look away, but I don't let go of him. A man like this deserves to know that I am his friend and that his sovereign sees his sacrifices. That is why I hold him for several minutes and spoil him with attention. Welcome home, I say to them over his head. I let go of him and hold his head in my hands. You most of all, my friend, you most of all. Welcome home. He smiles up at me with incandescent love because he feels that his presence is welcome when he doubted it would be.
I just fucking love Virginia so much for all of this and feel like so much for Screwface. Yeah. This is just, it's really nice. You know, not that Darrow didn't see him at all, but he didn't see him the way Virginia clearly always has. And the fact that she's like, I just want him to know that I love him and he's welcome and I appreciate everything he's done. There's others there. I mean, she's got to be like, you'd think she'd be closer to Thraxa because Thraxa is a Telemannus.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe Thraxa is old enough that Virginia didn't spend too much time with her when she was with them, but still, it just shows so much about Virginia herself, and I love it. I love it.
Yeah. I guess we always have Darrow being like, and how best can I use you to obtain my objective? Then we'll go drinking afterwards.
I'm not saying Darrow mistreated or didn't appreciate Screwface. But it's just very clear that Virginia sees him in a way that possibly no one else does.
Well, I mean, that's been one of her biggest strengths as a leader, mm-hmm. which is why I think she is a better leader than Darrow. I think Darrow is a better warrior.
Oh, of course. Virginia,
but Virginia's like, whose plan am I going to trust more?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Scott, especially at this point. We talked about that in our first episode for Lightburner, The Reluctant Messiah, with, oh, here's Darrow again, prancing off to do a rescue with like zero plan and no backup plan. And
well, I mean, his backup plan was a bomb.
Yeah.
Which was good until we found out that Apple had magic bomb locators.
Mm.
Still salty about that one.
Well, after Virginia says, hey, now we've got to go fight because the core goals are apparently coming, y'all. I don't know how much time passes between when they find out from Thraxa and Calloway, et cetera, that the core golds are coming and when the sequence in the chapter, The Rising Dirge, happens. But they go down to the Mines of Lycos to have this big symbolic meeting. And the fact that it's Deanna, Darrow's mother, who's the person who gives the speech in Lycos, is so powerful. And she does it so perfectly. And for me, anyway, it's hard to say which part is better. When she reminds everyone that the enemy has come to make them slaves again, announcing, so today we are not dreamers, we are not colors, we are swords, we are wrath, we are reapers. But then they destroy the gallows where Darrow and Io and so many others were hung, and oh, that's also so great.
And finally, Darrow's sister Leanna comes around with a pail, and Deanna glares into Virginia's eyes, and as Virginia looks into her mother-in-law's eyes, she understands where Darrow got his rage. Then Deanna wipes red Martian mud over Virginia and Victor's sigils and tells them, go, Daughters of Mars, and be our wrath. Although, again, given where the Reds came from, it's probably more like, go, Daughters of Mars, and be our wrath, or something like that, but only angrier.
Talking about these three things, I would say, like, well, as powerful as them destroying the gallows are, that's probably not my favorite part of this Rising Dirge. It's probably the Martian mud wiping it over their sigils.
I mean, that's the very powerful. We're not gold anymore. We're Mars, right? Mm-hmm. We're all Mars out there fighting to prevent the return of the old order and all that it entails.
Yeah, it's got the physical aspect of the wiping of the mud that is similar to them actually destroying the gallows in that it's an actual physical act. But then also Deanna's words, you are daughters of Mars, you be our wrath. So it's the combination of the physical action from destroying the gallows and the words, we aren't dreamers, we aren't colors, we're swords, we're wrath, we're reapers. This chapter was really great. Like, I literally had chills when I was reading it. I really like this. And a lot of that was definitely because, like I said, I think it was really powerful that it was Deanna who did this. You know, Darrow's not there and it was so important for someone close to him to be part of it, but it was so much better for it to be his mother, especially it being in Lycos, it happening in Lycos versus it being Virginia or Victra, you know?
Yeah, no, Deanna was the perfect choice for this, not only because she's the Reaper's mom, but also because she suffered in the mines. And it's also really good because it's like, hey, everybody, don't forget. Some people have been trying to tell us that this was a bad idea. It's not a bad idea. It's a very good idea. And we need to trust the people who kind of got us out of this the last time.
Right after that, sadly, Victra and Virginia have to part ways. But before they do, we also get this really great conversation where we see Victra through Virginia's eyes, because we haven't seen Victra thought about or talked about in a light like this one since Darrow is thinking about her in Morningstar.
Virginia describes Victra as daunting to behold in either peace or war. Her stature is tyrannical, tall, broad, muscular, with knives for cheekbones. Her nature matches proud, brutal, voluble, but in her is a font of love that glows so hot it burns her from the inside out. For years, I did not see that. I saw only her sharp edges. Now I love her and realize she was a sister I never wanted but always needed.
Then Victra murmurs, you're the bookish one. Was it a man who said hell hath no fury like a woman scorned? It must have been, to imagine something so petty as scorn to be the utmost misery a woman could suffer. What, I wonder, would he make of a mother who has seen her husband sold like meat and her babe nailed to a tree? Perhaps, wrath, I am thee? They come for our children, Virginia. Do not fear for me. Instead, pity them.
No killing Victra, either.
Yeah.
Especially no sneaky killing of Victra by Severo because he got mind-fucked. I will be so angry. And I'm going to need to make sure to get the last book as a physical copy because I've gotten all of the others as ebooks. And if I want to throw something across the room, it's not going to be my phone.
Keep something next to you to throw across the room just in case.
No, I'll just get Storm of Swords out.
Yeah, that can
I never threw my copy, but I think in terms of the book that wins the title of most copies thrown at a wall.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah, the highest percentage of readers who threw a book at a wall, definitely Storm of Swords.
But, oh man, Victra.
Well, and you haven't liked Victra all of the time.
No, and I think I still have some strong disagreements with her on the subject of privilege and who deserves it and why maybe it's not great to buy and sell people, contracts or no contracts. But I know which side of her I want to be on in this conflict. It's not across the battle lines.
Yeah, especially after her seeing Severo sold at auction like that. And even more than that, what happened to Ulysses in Dark Age. But also just to touch on the wording of this passage, because I've never really cared for the quote or cared about the quote, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. I've always kind of brushed it off like, it's very cliche sounding. I don't care for it. But I never actually really thought about the fact that, wow, that is such a petty thing. When I think back at the times I've been the most pissed in my life, the most upset, etc., it was never because somebody scorned me, for lack of a better word. Never for that.
It's the way men were/are conditioned to look at women. And also, given the time when the quote came from, is that the amount of life choices women were able to make for a very long time was nil. So if your entire future is you've got to marry somebody because otherwise you're screwed and then you get scorned, there's more to it than just I got jilted by somebody. But yes, I do agree that it is really petty.
Well, it's funny that, well, I guess because they're kind of, as we talked about in the previous episode, the Lysander episode, the Eager Messiah, or I actually don't know if we delved into this too much, but when Atlas came to visit him at the play, and it's like all they ever do is like the Greek plays and, yeah, and stuff like that, Ovid and everything. Yeah. And I did actually look up where this quote came from, but it's from a play from the late 1600s, so yeah, the late 17th century. It's called The Mourning Bride, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, right, yeah, by, oh my gosh, William Congreve? Yes, there you go. Thank you.
William Congreve. Yeah.
So yes, it is from a man, and also the time frame, late 17th century. And also, yeah, I actually don't know what the play is about. I didn't get that far in my looking things up, but I get it. Time frame.
You know, it's also,
I don't think I've ever seen this actually discussed before.
No, I don't think.
And people still share this quote like it's some sort of pithy.
Right. Like it's some sort of wise observation. Oh, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Well, also to take the flip side of that, I feel a certain way if I get turned down or ghosted or whatever the crap. So it's like, yeah, only women. Because, you know, look at how angry she is. She's been scoring. I'm like, yeah, it feels shitty. It's not a good feeling.
I'm not going to say like it doesn't feel shitty, but yeah, it is certainly not even close to, I would not call anything that I felt about it wrath or fury.
Yeah.
You know, pissed off sometimes, upset sometimes, sad sometimes.
Yeah, fury's a weird, it really is sort of a failure of imagination.
Well, I guess in 1690 yeah, something, it wasn't so much, but
maybe not. Well, I mean, Shakespeare's got a couple of female characters who certainly get pretty angry over things that don't involve being scorned. But then he's got some other stuff that's not so great. So who knows?
Well, with that, they part ways, and Virginia is off to Phobos with Kavix and Holiday to kick off a battle that she thought she and Darrow would face together, which is the battle. Oh, God. Yeah. I don't want to get into it because we'll talk about it in our next episode a lot, obviously.
Yes, we will.
But it's a little bit sad that she's going with her most trusted general, Holiday, and her most trusted father figure slash also General Kavix. But she always thought that if it came down to fighting for Mars like this, it would be her and Darrow again, because it has been before too. And it's like, yeah, oh.
It's time for In Memoriam. Lyria's search crew, comprised of Oxus the Orange Mechanic, Zarya the Blue Pilot, and Fel the Heavy Metal Red. We hardly knew them, but probably would have loved them. I agree.
I want to see a backstory about what was going on with them, where they were, what they were doing before they met Lyria and ended up vaporized on an asteroid. Right?
What are they doing?
It also kind of sounds like a sitcom where it was like a gray, a red, and a violet, I think, were living in an apartment together in Hyperion City on Luna. This could also be a sitcom, honestly.
I missed that, apparently. But do you know what that reminds me of? Hey, everybody, it's time for Seth to make a cultural reference that it's at least 30 years out of date. Do you remember The State? I do. It was a short-lived sketch comedy group that was on MTV for 3 years in the 90s. And they had a sitcom that they did twice. It was called The Jew, the Italian, and the Redhead Gay. And it was just three members of The State being stereotypes. That was it.
Yeah, it's a reference that's mentioned in passing in Iron Gold, and we had a probably far too lengthy, obviously it wasn't an episode you were on, but we had a probably far too lengthy conversation about what the sitcom would be like and how we would love to see it. But this is also something I would love to see, and also sounds like a sitcom, you know, like yeah, the Orange Mechanic, the Blue Pilot, Fell the Heavy Metal Red. Maybe less yeah, a sitcom and more of a like Expanse style show, like out in space.
You know what I think? I think if you're lucky, you can hire the A-team. Dun, 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 dun.
If we want to make it more amusing. Well, as we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our heroes, to your patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with practically permanent guest host Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Our next episode, titled The Battle for Phobos, will cover Virginia and Lysander's POVs from chapter 20 through chapter 31 in part 2 of Lightbringer. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.